From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, we examine the deadliest wildfire season in 20 years and why experts are saying it's more than just bad luck.
In Arizona, they kind of have every aspect of our Western fire crisis in spades.
Then some world music that disregards borders. Agua bella. And baseball's real Moneyball team. Turns out they're playing right now.
They're not even household names in their own households.
How the novel Gone with the Wind has struck a deep chord in North Korea.
You could change the names, and it could be a North Korean talking when they're saying, you know, I might starve, but I'm standing up to those Yankees.
And author Shahan Mufti finds his own family's history intertwined with that of Pakistan.
My maternal side of my family actually traced its lineage and its roots back to the inner circle of the Prophet Muhammad.
Plus the poetry and music of war.
Look around, prepare the house, don't hurt the children. New York is so far away.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. This has been a deadly year for people who fight wildfires. In all, 32 people have lost their lives fighting wildfires in 2013. That's the highest number in nearly 20 years. And just one incident accounts for most of those deaths, the Yarnell Hill Fire in Arizona. It blasted through a firefighting crew known as the Granite Mountain Hotshots. 19 of the 20 men died. A new report has released some new information about what happened to the hotshots. But around the country, as people move further into wildland areas and climate change turns landscapes into tinder, experts say the wildfire danger will likely only grow. And that's our cover story today, Living with Wildfires.
Andrew Ashford is 29 years old. Anthony Rose, 23 years old.
The day after the accident, Fire Chief Dan Fryho stood in front of cameras and reporters inside a high school gym in Prescott, Arizona, an hour north of Phoenix.
Grant McKenzie, 21. Jess Steed.
Fryho read the names of the 19 members of the elite Granite Mountain Hotshot crew who died in the Yarnell Hill fire. The fire started from a lightning strike that sparked a brush fire. A fire hadn't hit the area in more than 45 years. It was primed to burn. Powerful winds spread the flames across thousands of acres in a matter of hours, catching residents unaware. Jerry Jones Floorman and Michelle Jacobson had to leave their homes at a moment's notice.
Oh, in the end, it was like 5 minutes. Get your stuff and go.
Now, move. Get out of your house. And people were really literally running for their lives to get out in time.
Deployed between the flames and the people's property were the hotshots. 21-year-old Brendan McDonough was the 20th member of the elite crew and a lone survivor. He was the lookout and was separated from the group. In an interview with the Prescott Daily Courier, McDonough remembers the tension of that day.
My captain had reached me on the radio saying that we're going to expect a 180-degree wind shift and that we could expect gusts up to 50 to 60 miles per hour. And once I heard that, I knew the fire was going to change rapidly, and he understood that too.
The hotshots moved away from a burned-out area, which was safe, and toward a ranch, another safe zone. But along the way, the winds shifted, and fire trapped the hotshots. The crew leader radioed back that they were deploying fire shelters, a last resort.
That was the last time that I heard my superintendent's voice. And what went through my mind when I heard that they had to deploy, I was crushed.
The bodies of the firefighters were found several hours later. Investigators have tried to piece together exactly what happened in the Yarnell Hill fire. Yesterday, the Arizona State Forestry Division released their incident report. Jim Carls led the investigation.
My entire objective is to give the state of Arizona to our best ability what happened on the Yarnell Hill fire and to ensure that we learn from that into the future.
They reported that the fire was moving fast, more than 10 miles per hour. In the end, the hotshots had just 2 minutes to prepare shelters. When the fire came, it was burning at more than 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, hot enough to melt silver. An air tanker was poised and ready to drop flame retardant above the hotshots, but they had no way of knowing their position. The report does not assign blame, though it does cite a critical 30-minute gap in communications. And investigators say they cannot explain one central mystery: why the firefighters moved away from a safe area and into danger. Here's investigator Jim Carls.
We don't know that information. We don't have it. That decision-making process went with those 19 men.
Yeah, one thing that they point out repeatedly is that the only explanation for the Granite Mountain hotshots to have left a safety zone in an already burnt forest, which is where they were, was that they wanted to get to a place where they could re-engage the fire and try to prevent it from burning into the town of Yarnell.
Michael Kotas is writing a book about the wildfire crisis. He also worked as a seasonal firefighter. He was in Prescott in the days following the tragedy.
The primary purpose of these reports is to try to prevent an accident like this from happening again. But they also are trying to avoid saying things about firefighters who have perished and to downplay the heroism of these firefighters. And there's also legal constraints that have kind of fallen on them in recent years. About 10 years ago, there was a fire in which an incident commander was charged with crimes. And so there's a sense that if they point too many fingers or they're too pointed in their report, that firefighters and other officials might not be as cooperative with them as they might be because they fear there may be legal consequences for that.
Why was the Yarnell Hill fire so deadly?
Well, you know, in Arizona, they kind of have every aspect of our Western fire crisis in spades. This is largely a result of the fact that we've been putting out fires in the Western United States for more than a century. And this allowed our forests to grow unnaturally thick. And that's something that's really noticeable in Arizona. The forests there, after a century of fire suppression, often have 10 or 20 times more trees and scrub and grasses on them than they did naturally. You know, on the other side of that, they also have a rapidly expanding wildland-urban interface, which is the term that firefighters use to refer to the point where homes and communities abut really flammable forests. And so there's all kinds of development going on in Arizona in these very flammable forests.
And with people living in the wildland-urban interface, or WUI, has that changed the way we fight fires?
It has. Increasingly, wildland firefighters are being expected to somehow protect homes in the woods, and they're really not equipped for that in the way that a structure firefighter is. You know, they're wearing very lightweight flame-retardant clothing and just carrying the fire shelters like the Granite Mountain hotshots perished in. When a forest firefighter ends up trying to protect a house, they're really not prepared for the hazards that come with trying to protect a structure.
And I imagine that, you know, dealing in these kind of urban or sort of semi-urban areas, there are things like propane tanks and other sorts of hazards that these firefighters are really not accustomed to.
Yeah, that's correct. I went through my wildland firefighter fighting training again this last spring, and I hadn't gone through that in probably 10 years or so. And one of the most stunning changes in that training was parts of the training program that actually explained what to do if you happened upon a meth lab while you were fighting a forest fire, or an illegal chemical dump, or were dealing with homes with long and winding driveways in which access might be difficult, and it might be difficult to escape if you were fighting the fire and things went bad. And those really weren't things that we had to think very much about even 10 or 15 years ago when we were fighting forest fires.
That's Michael Kotas. He's the associate director of the Environmental Journalism Program at the University of Colorado. Experts say it's worth comparing the problem of wildfires with the nation's problem with building fires in the 20th century.
The worst school fire disaster in Chicago's history, one of the nation's worst ever, shocks the country.
Horror stories of massive, deadly building fires would punctuate newscasts. By the early 1970s, the U.S. had reached a crisis point. Fires were killing more than 12,000 Americans every year. the federal government established a commission and released a report called America Burning. Alexander Marangitis is a fire protection engineer with the National Institute of Standards and Technology. He says the America Burning report marked a major turning point in fire safety.
This was really the catalyst to really put together a research effort that resulted in significant improvements in the building codes and standards and test methods, which over decades has yielded a fantastic level of success.
Today, the number of deaths from fires every year is around 3,000, a fraction of the old number. But Marangitis says fires in the wildland-urban interface present a new and dangerous threat.
The wildland-urban interface problem, when compared to interior building fires, is technically, and I'm being conservative here, an order of magnitude more complex.
So Marangitis says understanding wildfires will require the kind of focus that the America Burning report once provided.
We are now with wildland-urban interface fires where we were with building fires 30 years ago.
Marangitis and his colleagues have proposed a scale to assess potential wildfire risk.
You can think of our proposed scale as a way to quantify the hazard.
The scale ranges from 1 to 4 and would measure the potential hazard from fires and hot embers. Marangitis says building codes have been developed to deal with earthquakes. They exist for hurricanes, too. But there is a big blind spot when it comes to understanding wildfires. He says the scale is not an attempt to restrict where people can build.
All we're saying is, at this point in space, this is the fire and ember exposure you can expect. So if you want to build there and you want your home to survive, the building materials and assemblies have to be able to withstand that exposure.
If the history of building fires is any guide, changing our approach won't take just years, but decades. In the meantime, we'll almost certainly see more devastating fires. As one expert told the Yarnell investigators, extreme fire behavior is the new normal. Again, this is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Coming up, we'll tell you who the real Moneyball team is. But first, a look inside North Korea. Tim Sullivan is Asia correspondent for the Associated Press, and he has spent much of the last year reporting on the secretive, totalitarian regime, including many weeks reporting from inside the country. His most recent trip had some unexpected moments. Tim, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
As you've been to North Korea over the last year, you've got to know some of the, well, we'd call them social hotspots. I don't know if that's the right word for them in Pyongyang. But can you describe the scene at the Gold Lane bowling alley?
It's one of my favorite places in the city. Picture a large 1970s bowling alley. It's a big place for soldiers now. You go there bowling, and the soldiers take off their shirts. They love to bowl in their sleeveless white T-shirts, showing off their muscles. Their girlfriends are parading around in their short skirts and high heels. And everybody plays with bowling balls that all say Made in America on them. Although they look like at least 30 years old. They're so badly pitted. It's a good place to see, though. I mean, it was basically illegal to wear a short skirt in North Korea until somewhere around a year ago. They now do have sort of a consumer ideal, which didn't exist there before.
And something else they have access to now, which is one of the weirder parts in many weird scenes you describe in this piece, they have access to a translation of Gone with the Wind. Could you talk about how that book has captured the North Korean imagination?
To me, it's one of the most shocking things that I stumbled across there. Every person I came across in Pyongyang, every single person had read it. And it was interesting. I'd never read Gone with the Wind before, and I read it while I was there. I mean, the story is, a lot of it is about suffering. It's about the Yankees treating people terribly. The North Koreans are really proud of how they've suffered, and they're really proud of how they've stood up to the Yankees. There are times you read that book, and you could change the names, and it could be a North Korean talking when they're saying, you know, I might starve, but I'm standing up to those Yankees. The kind of things that Scarlett O'Hara says are really echo strongly the things that you can easily hear in Pyongyang.
Have they seen the movie? Is that available?
There are some people who have seen it. They actually use it for language training, which I find rather odd. I don't know if they'd come out with, you know, rather stilted language.
It'll be odd if we have a generation of North Koreans speaking English
with sounding like, you know, Scarlett O'Hara.
I'm going to live through this, and when it's all over, I'll never be hungry again. No, not any of my food.
Exactly. I mean, that's all. I mean, when he told me it was he'd seen part of it at his language institute, I just thought it was the strangest things. But you get used to a lot of strange things in North Korea.
So everywhere you go in North Korea, you're accompanied by your government minder. Could you talk about your relationship with him?
I actually almost always have two minders. Mr. Ha is our main minder. He's with me all the time. I could probably count the number of times I've gone anywhere without him. He's a very proper man. He's always very carefully dressed. With someone like Mr. Ha, it would be easy for me to sort of see him as this caricature of a World War II Nazi or something like that. But he's not. He's a guy. He's got a kid that he worries about. He's got a wife, and he's got a job that he's got to do. And so I try not to see myself as a crusader there. I try to view him as a person, even though I admittedly there are days where we butt heads pretty regularly.
You said that, you know, for people that you're interviewing in North Korea, how they answer these questions can be life or death issues for them. So doesn't that sort of paralyze you for being able to ask anything? How do you function?
Yeah, it is. It can be really challenging. Every once in a while, people do open up to you. I've had people say some shockingly personal things. Often I don't even use the quotes because certainly if they're critical in the least, these people would go to jail. It's not normal reporting in the least. It's not like I go to North Korea and I emerge with the kind of story I could do anywhere else in the world. I might come out with 30% of a story, but I almost never get the whole story there because I know that these people are so constrained, and I know that even if they want to tell me something honest, they probably can't.
That's Tim Sullivan. You can read about his time in North Korea in the latest issue of National Geographic, and we have a slideshow of some incredible photos taken by the photographer who traveled with Tim. That's at our website, npr.org. Today is the last day of Major League Baseball's regular season. The playoffs start Tuesday, and among the teams still vying for a spot in the World Series is the club with the fourth lowest payroll in the game.
The American League's Western Division title belongs to the Oakland Athletics.
Now, if you remember, the Oakland A's are the same team that Michael Lewis profiled in the book Moneyball. Brad Pitt played general manager Billy Bean in the movie, and Billy Bean is still there in Oakland, winning divisions on thrifty budgets. Sports writer Alan Barra wrote in The Atlantic that this year's A's are the real Moneyball team, not the 2002 squad. Alan Barra joins us from our New York studios to explain. Hi, Alan.
Hi.
Okay, so let's start with 2002, the Moneyball team that was portrayed in the movie a couple of years ago. For those of us who read the book or saw the movie, we know the story. It's the A's can't compete with the big wealthy teams to sign their marquee players, so they start using obscure statistics to find the best available players at rock-bottom prices, and it works. What's wrong with that story?
Well, it's not true. for one thing, the big statistic they talk about, on-base average, has been known for years. People have been talking about that for many years. And the reason that they did win wasn't primarily these low-rent players they picked up. It was the near-superstar-level players that they had. Eric Chavez at third base, Miguel Tejada, who was, in fact, the MVP of the 2002 season. And they had great starting pitching, probably the best 1-2-3 starters in the American League and maybe in all of baseball. Now, mm-hmm. Scarcely mentioned, not even mentioned at all in the movie. And you see the A's, in fact, lose in the playoffs in 2002, not to a big money team like the Yankees or Red Sox. They end up losing to the Minnesota Twins, who, according to Forbes, were actually a smaller market team in 2002. So there's a lot of miss there to knock down.
Okay, so let's take a minute. Can we give Billy Bean some credit? I mean, he did amazing things in Oakland, right?
Oh, yes. No doubt. A very smart man and a very good GM. But it's a myth that baseball in recent years, in the last few decades, has been dominated by rich teams. It's true the Yankees spend an incredible amount of money. I think it was, what, $190 this year? $190 million? But where are they at the end of the season?
But the Yankees they've won 27 World Series. There have been two in the last decade, three in the 90s. They've been pretty routinely excellent, and they spend a ton of money. So does that kind of mean that, that money still wins games?
Well, the Yankees, let's say from 1996 on, when their streak started, only in 1998 were they really a great powerhouse team. It was a 2001 or 2002. They won their playoff series against the A's, but during the season, the A's were a much better team. I think they won 10 or 11 more games than the Yankees did during the season.
So can you talk through how this year's team more closely resembles that myth, as you call it?
Well, this year, the A's are doing very much what they were credited for doing, I think, back in 2002. This year's bunch, they're not even household names in their own households. Josh Donaldson, I think he's going to finish with 25 home runs this year, and he's making less than $500,000. They've got an Australian player, Grant Balfour, a 35-year-old, much-traveled veteran who is a terrific relief pitcher. And Ryan Cook, a very good setup man, making a little over $500,000. I mean, these guys are the real Moneyball team.
Alan Barra wrote about the 2013 Oakland A's for The Atlantic. Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Before I moved here to Los Angeles, I'd always known about California's diverse population, but in the abstract. I really didn't know about the true impact on its culture, how California looks up close, how it tastes, how it sounds. And there's no better guide through the diverse sounds of California than the host of KPFK's Global Village, LA's own Beto Arcos. Beto, glad to finally meet you.
Hey, Arun. Welcome to LA.
Thank you. It's great to be here. So, I know you're excited about this band that we're listening to now. They sound great, by the way. Who is this?
This is literally a band of brothers. These were six brothers. Four of them were born in the state of Zacatecas in north central Mexico. They moved here about 20 years ago. And wouldn't you know it, they formed a band that plays Cuban music. One of the brothers actually bought a CD of compilation of salsa music, and he was so grabbed by the sound that he said, I want to do this. I want to play. And he learned how to play the instruments. Mm-hmm. And then he recruited his brothers to join him and learn the instruments. In fact, some of them he taught himself. And pretty soon they have a band. This is, believe it or not, their first record.
Wow. They're tight. That's yeah. Pretty tight for a first record. But it sounds like you said, it's sort of old school Afro-Cuban. You could almost expect Dizzy Gillespie to be coming in and play on top of that.
Absolutely. They're very, very good musicians. And like I said, they've been playing for about 20 years or so, but they never recorded their own album. So this is it. I mean, you're hearing it first right here.
This is great. That's the band Son Mayor with a track called Agua Bella. Beto, there's been a lot of talk about the Latin influence in California, but it's also America's gateway to Asia, and I know there's a huge Asian population here. How does that show up in the music scene?
Oh, geez, there are musicians from Korea, from China, from Vietnam, from Iran, actually, too. And in fact, this next tune is a collaboration between an Indian musician, a sitarist, who's actually heir to a great family of sitarists, the son of the great Ustad Vilayat Khan. His name is Shuyat Khan, and he's joined here by an artist. She's Iranian. She doesn't live in Los Angeles. She lives in the East Coast, but they recorded this album here in Los Angeles.
So we have some Indian-Iranian fusion.
That's right. کلاتیف همچو جان سوگدم به تن رسید آه خجست ساعتی.
That's really nice. And it's, now I realize it's not going to sound unusual to a lot of our listeners because it'll just sound foreign. But for me, I'm hearing Indian music with Farsi, I think, sung over it.
Exactly. That's what it is. It's a confluence of Indian music. Think of it as a sort of as a raga meets poetry of Rumi, recited by Katayoon Godarsi. It's a beautiful record. I just love the sound of the two arts coming together.
The other thing that this reminds me of is Indian devotional music. They're called bhajans. They're like devotional songs to God. But here, what's unusual is we're hearing the poetry of Rumi as opposed to Hindu poetry.
Which is, you know what? I'm glad you mentioned that because this is a ghazal. A ghazal is a love poem.
Yeah.
It's very similar to the bhajan that you're talking about.
So. Right. And ghazals are these intense, almost obsessive love songs.
That's right. This poem is about the pain, the longing of missing somebody when that person is not with you and you're longing painfully for that person.
Classic.
آن سر زلف سر کشت گفت مرا که شب خوشت.
Again, that's the music of Shujat Khan and Katayoon Godarsi. That's a piece called Sanama. My guest is world music DJ Beto Arcos, and he's introducing us to some of the diverse music coming out of California these days. I've got a little hint about this next one, Beto. It's a take on the French composer Eric Satie's Nocturne No. 3. The Satie version is a piano arrangement. I gotta say, I like this a lot better than the original. What's the name of this artist?
Her name is Van Anh Vanessa Vo. She's from Vietnam. She's been living in the San Francisco Bay Area for a number of years. She's playing this monochord called the Dan Bao, which is a one-string instrument. And this is her fantastic rendition of this, as you say. It's Eric Satie's Nocturne No. 3.
It's gorgeous, and I have to say, I don't want to offend anybody, but one of the things I like less about Satie is that I feel he sounds a little bit sentimental, and I feel like this loses that quality.
Right, and I love the way she stretches that note. It almost sounds like a slide guitar.
Yeah, feels kind of bluesy, too. That's Van Anh Vanessa Vo with Satie's Nocturne No. 3. Beto, we have time for one more. What do you got for us?
The last tune is by a fantastic, very soulful singer from Venezuela that lives in the East Bay up north across San Francisco. Her name is Maria Marquez, and her song is called Entre Copa y Copa.
La vida me ha marcado un sino tan fatal. Que hay veces que no quiero de ti ni recordar.
Oh, that voice. It reminds me of Nina Simone.
Yeah, she has this kind of liquid approach to singing. And this is a bolero, bolero being a romantic love song from Latin America. Mm-hmm. But here, it's an arrangement almost like a jazz standard with American instruments, with American musicians. Huh. It's a very beautiful song by a well-known composer from Venezuela, Felipe Pirela. Beautiful stuff, Entre Copa y Copa.
I love it. What is she singing about?
It's a torch song. It's all about, you know, you've left me, I'm in pain, I'm drinking and drinking because I have no other choice. You know, you're gone, I'm left behind, I'm in pain.
That seems to be a theme, this feeling of longing and wanting more. And Beto, you're leaving us wanting more. So you got to come back sometime soon and bring some more music.
I'd be very happy to do that. It's a pleasure to be here with you, Arun. And welcome once again to this, our wonderful city of Los Angeles.
Thank you. It's so great to be here. Again, that music we're hearing, that's Maria Marquez with the song Entre Copa y Copa. Beto Arcos has been with me. He's the host of The Global Village on KPFK here in Los Angeles. You can go to our website for a longer listen to all the music you just heard. That's at nprmusic.org. It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Joining me now is Shahan Mufti. His new book, The Faithful Scribe, is a look at the history of Pakistan, the world's first Islamic democracy, that nation's relationship with the U.S., and how Mufti's own family story is part of the tumultuous history of Pakistan. Shahan Mufti is a journalist who writes for numerous publications, including Harper's, The Atlantic Monthly, and The New York Times Magazine. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
You write that your own family's history is entwined with Pakistan. Could you explain how that is?
Well, this is a family history that I came to pretty late. My grandfather had passed away, and it was among his whatever was left of his life and some papers that I found a family tree that showed me that my maternal side of my family actually traced its lineage and its roots back to the inner circle of the Prophet Muhammad. And so this was fascinating history, and it forced me to think that maybe the history of what I was writing and the context for what I was writing about as a news reporter wasn't even, you know, a couple months or a couple years old. This thing went back, way back.
And you're very much a man of two countries. You're an American and a Pakistani. Can you talk about your life and how you split between the two countries?
Well, yeah, that is definitely. I think there are others like me as well somewhere.
There are a lot,
more and more. A huge impetus for me in writing this book was actually being on both sides of this present conflict, where America is involved in this war in Afghanistan. And as we know, the place of Pakistan in this conflict is very dubious and questionable.
Well, let's talk about that going back to the beginning. You were in college, correct, when the 9/11 attacks happened in 2001?
That's right. Being Pakistani and being American had never really been something that I'd spent too much time thinking about. This was not an issue. This was in no way a challenge.
The two sides weren't in conflict.
Not really. It's not something that was really a challenge to me. But the point of departure in the book is the day after September 11th when I received a phone call from a federal agent who just wanted to know how I was doing.
In your dorm room?
In my dorm room. So I was not up yet. I didn't have class that day. So I was sleeping in. And it was early in the morning and I got a phone call. It was a double ring, so I knew it was off campus. And the federal agent, you know, just asked me mundane questions about what I was doing and how I was doing, if I was all right. He made no mention of the events of the day before, which was strange. But it did make me think of why I was pinpointed in my dorm room in rural Vermont on the day after.
And do you think it's because of your name that's why you got that phone call?
I suspected, yes. And being Muslim, and this was the time, really, we should remember that these ideas of a clash of civilization and these ideas that Islam is inherently locked in some sort of conflict with the Western way of life and Western ideals, that is when we really started talking about it.
You opened your book talking about the stereotypes a lot of Americans have of Pakistan, especially after the 9/11 attacks. And, you know, my own background, I'm of Indian extraction. I've had an idea of Pakistan. And when I realized over time that that idea was based on friends who were basically like you, Shahan, who come from a certain part of Pakistani society. And then in 2003, when Danny Pearl was killed in Karachi, it was a real, it messed with my mind. It was almost like that country that I thought existed, I didn't understand it anymore.
And that's something I deal with in the book throughout, is this idea of the violence as a solution to anything. But we shouldn't gloss over the very real challenges that Pakistan and America have had, especially in the last decade, since the war in Afghanistan started. The one country in the world that hates the United States most in public polls is Pakistan. And the one country in the world that Americans hate, well, Pakistan was tied with Iran. And so these are two countries there where the populace have come, you know, to become very suspicious of each other, of the other, and yet the two countries remain, quote, closely allied in the war.
So we're again at one of these fatefully important crossroads in America and Pakistani relations. Looking down the road after the withdrawal from Afghanistan is complete, where do America and Pakistan go from here?
Well, I think that's a very important question, a very relevant question. The short answer is nowhere. Where Pakistan and the United States remain right where they are, which is, like I said, tied in their geography and history. We've really been focused on Pakistan's western border for a decade and more now, Afghanistan and Iran. These are two countries that obviously are very relevant to American foreign policy. I think the focus is going to turn more onto Pakistan's eastern border. And on Pakistan's eastern border, we have India and China. Those are the two countries Pakistan borders on the eastern side. And Americans aren't escaping Pakistan anytime soon. And maybe that's not a bad thing. Maybe the story that America and Pakistan are about to write on the eastern border is about economic growth.
Shahan Mufti is a Pakistani-American journalist and writer. His new book is The Faithful Scribe, a story of Islam, Pakistan, family, and war. Shahan, thank you so much.
Thanks, and it was great to be with you today.
This is the poetry of war.
Taliban gone, but snaps of bullets cackle from beneath the hut. A witch, a girl of dust and shrub mocks me there.
The still fresh memories of U.S. combat veterans had been transformed into music by acclaimed jazz composer Vijay Iyer. The voice you're hearing belongs to Mike Ladd, Iyer's partner on a series of projects, all about the lives of people of color since 9/11. This latest work features lyrics culled from interviews they conducted with Iraq and Afghanistan vets. It's called Holding It Down, the Veterans Dreams Project.
My finger, molten bone. I squeeze intent, I'm watching my victim's head explode.
Vijay Iyer says this album is less about archiving the experiences of war and more about how vets live with the weight of those memories.
Now that people have come home and they're among us, I mean, it's a few million people. It's all of our problem. So now what do we do?
Maurice Edison, the call is not here. That foolish man stayed in Iraq. He likes a bed.
This track features the voice of Maurice DeCaul. He served in Iraq as a Marine and led a battalion into An-Nasiriya in 2003. DeCaul returned home that year, but he didn't start writing poetry until 2009.
It took a long time to be able to think through what had happened in Iraq. And around that time, around 6 years after the deployment, I needed an outlet, and I was lucky enough to find one through NYU's Veterans Writing Workshop.
Maurice, the track Derelict Poetry, it seems to be about imagined scenarios for yourself. You imagine staying in Iraq rather than returning home, and you imagine dying on the battlefield.
Maurice Edison DeCaul is dead. I lied. He died 6 years ago today. He died at night in a firefight behind a mud brick house.
You know, you go to places like Iraq, and there's always the possibility that you might not make it back home. So the poem starts talking about how the main character, he's not home, he's never come home, and he's still in Iraq, he's still just hanging out with the Bedouins. Well, what that really means is, you never really do come home fully. Your mind might still be there. There's always a trace of the war, there's always a trace of the Marine Corps. Then it goes into talking about how that possibly could have happened, that one doesn't make it home. And I was an infantryman when I was in Iraq. And you go out on something, on a mission that feels very familiar to you because you've been doing it for months on end every single day. That particular day that you go out could be the last time.
He died at night, 19 hours from home, alone, dead from bullet fragments and hypovolemic shock.
Vijay, I'm kind of curious about the composition process because it's not sung. But it's not quite spoken word. It's sort of like almost that Gil Scott-Heron Last Poets kind of rhythmic talking. So
you can say rap on NPR.
Anyway, hip-hop?
That's right. No, I mean, we have a lot of points of reference for this. And to be honest, we weren't really trying to sound like any specific thing. Mm-hmm. We were really just trying to make something together. Yeah. And so when you do that, when you just sit in a room for a week or a year, or in this case, what, three and a half years?
Yeah.
You find some things that work and some things that don't. We kind of approached it in a lot of different ways, and some of the pieces on the album are sung, and some of them are spoken, very plain spoken. Some of them, I think it can be called rap. like the piece called On Patrol.
Wake up, look down, left boot dog tag. Make sure it's there, jingling around the neck. Black sounds is wrapped in black mat. Electrical tape will help ID the remnants, turning from dust to dust.
That's Maurice basically rapping. That's what's happening there.
And that's kind of a stream of consciousness piece. Maurice, can you talk about that one, On Patrol?
Well, now I'm thinking about it. On Patrol is also referencing that same incident in Derelict Poetry. It was an ambush, trying to create the environment of going out on a patrol and being ambushed. And what does that feel like? It's a very chaotic event, and training kicks in. So the poem starts to really think through what that event feels like.
Rattle, crackle, rat-a-tat-tat, kaboom, swish, ting, clink, thud.
I was interested in recreating some of the sounds, because, you know, there's machine gun fire, and there's always machine gun fire in Iraq. But that was an important part of the poem, too, just trying to recreate the sounds of battle and that particular ambush.
Thumb press, slide it open, insert here, snap, click, and close. Pull the trigger and unleash the fake sun. Duck, look down, dog tag still there. Tear, click another, cordite in the air. Look around, clear the house. Don't hurt the children. New York is so far away. If you die, dog tags.
It's sort of wild that the project is called the Veterans Dreams Project. Insomnia is a theme here, and even the kind of killing of that dream state is sort of a theme. Maurice, was that a problem that you faced?
When I came home, I would be able to sleep, and I don't remember this, but my wife would talk about how at night I would wake up and I would maybe hit her or wrestle with her or fight with her, and that is something that kept happening. That happened for a few years. I don't personally remember that.
There was also, you know, when Mike did a lot of interviews of other veterans too, and some of the people he interviewed said they didn't dream at all, and if they did, it was a medicated kind of sleep. So that's where the song REM Killer comes from, is the kind of, it's a litany of all the medications that people would take to not have to relive some of these memories in the course of sleep.
Oxycontin, Percocet, Percocet, dreams, white cap, push and twist, night cap, breath on my pillow better than my heartbeat, sounding like men walking on leaves towards my bed.
Maurice, what do you hope that listeners will take away from this collection?
That's a good question, something that we talk about. What I'm really hoping for is that we'd be able to create a space for dialogue. I think it's really important. I mean, we're drawing down Afghanistan next year, so that's another 60,000 or so troops coming home. And it's funny, I was speaking with another vet this morning, and he was talking about how, you know, when folks first come home, it might take them a few years before they are willing to talk. But what I'm hoping is that the project will create the space so that if people do want to talk, maybe we could model the way that this could be done.
Finally, Vijay, I have to ask you, because just days ago it was announced that you were the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant, as they're called. Of course, we knew you were a genius because we had booked this well ahead of that. So $625,000 over the next 5 years, no strings attached. What are you going to do?
Oh.
Put you on the spot.
And it's kind of early. You know, it's still kind of sinking in.
Yeah.
That it's sort of like, welcome to the rest of your life. You know, what are you going to do now? But basically, if I can keep doing this kind of work and hopefully keep inspiring others, then I'll feel like I've done something good with it.
Nice. Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And congratulations also on this amazing album. That's pianist and composer Vijay Iyer with Marine and poet Maurice DeCall. Their new collaboration is called Holding It Down, the Veterans Dreams Project. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thanks, Irwin.
Thank you.
When I dream of normalcy.
For the week ending September 29th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, and Jody Becker. Our intern is Francesca Fenzi. The technical director is Patrick Murray. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on Saturday and Sunday. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.